Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation, and we welcome people of all kinds. We welcome you, whatever your religious background was or is, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your family structure. And we also welcome you no matter what your age is or what your abilities or inabilities are. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They're either presented by a Prairie member, as is true today, a member of the wider community, or by our minister, Sandra Ingram. Today, Gary Peterson, who's a member of our congregation, will be talking about international charity best practices, and I'll tell you some of his background just before he speaks. K.K. Anderson will read our opening words for us.
It's a good quote. Give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day. Give a woman microcredit. She, her husband, and her extended family will eat for a lifetime. And that's from Bono.
Well, I'd like to introduce our speaker for today. It's Gary Peterson. Gary is the International Service Chair for the Evanston, Illinois, I guess that is, Evanston Lighthouse Rotary Club, and they give out about $20,000 a year in international aid. He's also participated in overseas projects in Guatemala on two occasions and once in Ecuador. He has an undergraduate degree in business as well as an MBA. And he runs his own commercial real estate appraisal firm in Chicago. And what's he doing here in Madison? Maybe he'll tell us. Gary.
So the PowerPoint was very easy to set up this morning, which tells me it probably will not work once we start. Then we need to hit a couple. So my topic today is about international charity, and I've traveled overseas several times on service projects through Rotary and on with our own family. And what became obvious to me after my very first trip is that our expectations in the United States and what we expect and what we think is helpful is often absolutely wrong, and a lot of the charity that we do is misguided and probably does not help or hurts in many cases. The first international service project I went on was with Rotary, and we went to Guatemala, and we worked on two projects there. One was with Actetamet, which is a high school for indigenous kids, and while on that project, we also went to another area. There had been a hurricane a few years earlier in Guatemala, and we were working on painting houses. And what is very common when church groups or service clubs go overseas to do something, they love to do construction projects. And so here we have our 40 people that were there painting houses that were going to be inhabited by the residents that live there. And while we're sitting there painting, a whole ton of people, local Guatemalans, were sitting there watching us paint. They were the people that were going to be moving into the facility or into the homes. They would have been perfectly happy to do the painting themselves. But we were there to be volunteers, so we're painting while they sit there watching us. One of the common misconceptions that Americans have is, because we like to get on the ground and do stuff, we like to have our boots on the ground, is that when you go on these projects, you kind of assume that what they need is somebody with energy to go there and paint and do stuff. So typically, you set a group of 15, 20, whatever number of people, a couple guys know what they're doing with construction, and the rest of us are unskilled laborers, essentially. Now, anybody that knows anything about poverty in third world countries know why do they have poverty? Because they have too many unskilled laborers with nothing to do. So what do most of us service organizations do? We send more unskilled laborers to the country to compete against the people that have no jobs. We don't like it when, for example, India takes some of our outsourced jobs and works for $5 an hour in India. but we do one better. We do it for free against the guy that only makes $2 an hour to begin with in Guatemala. And that's how we do service projects in large part in the United States. An analogy would be an unemployed carpenter. Let's say right after our recession 4 or 5 years ago that's still ongoing, let's take Milwaukee or Rockford or anywhere, you have a ton of unemployment, especially in the construction area. So let's say a Rotary Club or a church group from China or Guatemala decides we're going to go help the people in Rockford and we're going to do some construction work. Now, we don't need any of the unemployed carpenters or electricians. You just sit there and watch, okay? We're going to come in and we're going to fix the roofs and do all these things that need to get done, but you're not going to get paid. Now, if I was a construction guy, which I certainly am not, I would think, you know, these guys are undermining my capacity to feed my family. And they'd be right. But because we do it and we think it's charitable, we think we're wonderful people. And that's one of the fundamental problems that we have with the charity and service projects, is that our orientation is boots on the ground, let's get going, even though that's not necessarily what the people need. A big push in a lot of organizations now is when we do charity overseas, that sustainability is what we should emphasize. And sustainability means enhancing the capacity of that local community to do stuff themselves. And when what that means, though, is what if they can do something, they should be doing it. What they may need help with is stuff that they cannot do. As Americans, we're lucky. A lot of people, because of tourism or whatever reason, or it's the international language of business, is we speak English. A lot of countries love to have people speak English or to teach them how to speak English. That's something you can't do uniquely. Perhaps some medical services or things like water or vaccinations. Specific skilled things that are unique that we can contribute is what people need. They do not need unskilled laborers coming to flood the market. So between 1970 and 1998, the United States and other countries gave over $300 billion to Africa in aid. During that time period, the average growth in Africa was -0.2%. And a lot of that is because a lot of the aid is misdirected. It's either through corruption, it undermines society, it's really not doing what it's supposed to do, even though many of the ideas are noble and people go on these projects trying to help and being honestly trying to help. It's just because the economics and the unintended consequences of what we do often undermine what's going on. Economic. Yeah. Bill Easterly did a very comprehensive book and study in his book, The White Man's Burden, on the economics of aid. And he found that there is no correlation between economic growth and the amount of aid. Some countries do better when they have some aid. Other countries go in a nosedive. And just overall, there's no great correlation between all this money we spend on foreign aid and getting the results we want. Dambisa Moyo wrote Dead Aid, and she is an African-American woman that worked at the World Bank for many years and at Goldman Sachs. She recommends actually phasing out all aid to Africa over 5 years because she thinks it undermines capacity so much. In her book, and this is a pretty classic example of some of the problems you run into, in her book she talks about a very generous donor who donated 100,000 mosquito nets to an area in Africa because malaria is a serious problem and it kills a lot of people every year. So he donates 100,000 mosquito nets. Is that a good thing? On the face of it, you would think it is. The problem was there was a company there that employed 10 people that made about 5,000 mosquito nets a month. Now, no matter how efficient you are, you cannot stay in business if you're competing against somebody that gives away 100,000 mosquito nets and floods the market. So now what happens? This company employed 10 people. In Africa, in this part of Africa, a large number of dependents on every worker. You have large families, you may have parents, you may have nieces or nephews or sick relatives. In this company, the average was between 10 and 15 dependents for every employee. So as a result of this donation, that company went out of business, and now you have between 100 and 150 people that were self-sufficient on the company, now looking for handouts from the government. And then the next problem comes, 3 to 5 years from now, the mosquito nets have worn out. Now, we need somebody else to donate mosquito nets. And guess what? You'd be really stupid to start a company making mosquito nets knowing that some do-gooder is going to come in and wipe you out again in a couple of years. So what was a generous gift actually undermined capacity, and it put a lot of people out of work. Yeah. There's a lot of examples of something similar to this. Clothing donations in Africa. I was sitting on a plane a few years ago talking to a guy that was worked at an NGO in Africa in a relatively small town. And he said in that town, they got truckloads of free clothing, shoes, shirts, pants, whatever. And he said he was very good friends with a relatively wealthy family, actually, in that community. And he said, you know what? They never, ever buy clothes. They don't need to, because they may not be the greatest clothes in the world, but all of this free clothes comes. And he said, you know what? There's virtually no stores at all in this town that sell clothing, because they can't compete. Now, can you imagine living in Madison, or another small town, maybe make it easier to envision, in the United States, where there's no retail, or no clothing retail, let's say? What would that do to our unemployment rate? It would be massive. Food aid in Africa. And I'm going to get more to a local level pretty quickly, but some of these are sort of interesting. One of the ironies of food aid in Africa is you have countries that are starving where the farmers cannot sell their products and make any money. What happens is, and one of the big bugaboos in Kenya and many other areas where you have like these farmers that work on like 1 acre plots. And what happens is there's a famine or whatever, they're not making enough to produce. So countries like the United States, and the United States is actually the worst offender, will shipload boatloads of grain and then hand it out. What they don't do is they don't buy the grains from the local farmers first. They buy it because we're subsidizing farm production here. Our farmers will just make as much as they want, and the United States will buy it if there's too much. And then, even though it costs almost 4 times more by the time you get shipping and everything else to send it over to Africa, that's what they do. So the farmers in Africa can't support their own families because, once again, you're competing against massively devastated farm prices in an area with mass starvation. A smaller example would be books for a local area. Periodically, and I'm the chair of our International Service Club in Rotary in Evanston, and we're not big, we do about 20,000 a year, and we're constantly seeing people come in with proposals. And one guy comes in with a proposal, he wants to send all sorts of books to some community, doesn't matter where, I think it was Central America. And he wants to send all these books from the United States to this country. And it reminded me a couple years ago, last year, we were in, our family was in Ecuador, and we made a donation of $500 to buy books to help kids learn English in that area. And we went around with the people, this is where my son's going to be going actually, to try to find books. And it's hard to find books in these towns because there's not a lot of demand for books. So we found a few places where they sold about 20 books, and we cleared them out pretty much. We bought virtually a couple of everything. And then they hadn't spent all the money, they still had a couple $100, and then somebody emailed me and said, you know, we're going to try to go somewhere else to buy them. And I said, no, I'd really rather you buy them there. Because if you bring in books from outside, what happens? Well, they don't have much of a supply of books there. They only have 20 or 30, although there's some retail shop or resale shops if you go a little further out. So, but if you bring in books from somewhere else, well, this guy won't even bother carrying the 20 or 30 books that he's got. But if you buy all these books through him, and maybe even say, can you order a few more of different headers, well, now he may expand the number he has. And when we're bringing in books from the United States, you're certainly not encouraging their culture, you're encouraging American culture. And so essentially, we undermine in every way, you know, if the goal is to have people have books and hopefully encourage local writers, then you better be buying locally. But that's not what we as Americans like to do. Let's wait till the end. School supplies. Rotary, who's been doing this for 50 years, is as bad as a lot of people. This in Guatemala, we go, and I've gone a couple times, and this school, 500 kids for indigenous kids, and they're always broke, and they always need pencils, paper, books, everything. And so every time our district sends two groups of 10 or 20 every year. And every year they say, stuff your suitcase with shoes and books and pencils and paper. And they've gone to this place for like 8 years in a row now. It would make a lot more sense. And one of the Rotarians actually, as a joke, teaches entrepreneurism there. And it seems to me, and I've been on them for the last couple of years, and it hasn't changed much, that says, maybe I can just envision his entrepreneurism class with these kids. And the teacher would suggest, well, why don't you start a business doing selling boots? Well, we would. There was a guy that used to sell boots, but all these Rotarians keep coming in with all these boatloads of books or boots, and the same with paper, pens. We are unemployment people. We're not employment people. If an entrepreneur would say, why don't you help somebody set up a business, with internet and everything else, and then instead of Rotarians stuffing their suitcases with all this stuff, let them order it ahead of time, let the locals do it, and then you have a much more effective procedure. Because when you buy a book or whatever locally, that person then has to rent space where he's selling that book. He may have an employee. He may be then paying the taxes for that area. He may be hiring somebody else. And the money churns through the economy. In a typical economy, you may have a churn of 7 or 8 times of every dollar. In a third world country, maybe it's more because people are living paycheck to paycheck. Maybe it's less. I'm not exactly sure. But when you bring stuff in, you have, and so that's it's a virtuous cycle. When you bring stuff in, you have an unvirtuous cycle. Just like the mosquito nets. Instead of, had that guy bought local mosquito nets, it could have been a different story. But when we trash the local employers, you create a negative loop, and it has just the opposite effect. So as an example, short-term missions, like I was just talking about, like where I've gone to Guatemala and stuff, these things are becoming much bigger business. In 1989, there was about 120,000 people from the United States that went, whether it's church groups or Rotary clubs or other service clubs, on these projects. In 2006, it was 2,200,000 people, and they spent over $1.6 billion. Now, a sociologist from Calvin College, Kurt Verbeek, wanted to do a study to see how effective a lot of these projects were that people worked on. And in 1998, there was a hurricane in Honduras, Hurricane Mitch, which left 1.5 million people homeless. There was a church, the Christian International Development Corporation, was active in that area already before the hurricane hit. They did not have anything to do with construction or houses, but they were active in that area. And they decided they needed to work on housing for all these people. So most of the houses they then built, they just used their local guys, and they encouraged them and helped get it set up. And so these guys built, they built near 100,000 homes. Most of them were built in that process where they used the locals, local contractors, local builders, and did all that stuff. There was also 31 teams flown in from North America, primarily Canada, that built, just like, we've done them, Habitat for Humanity or something. I mean, it's that concept, but you do it overseas. So people would fly in, they would be building and all this kind of stuff, and they would build the house. Yeah. So when they use the local agencies, it costs $2,000 a home. When you use the North Americans, it costs $30,000 a home. And the reason isn't that these North American volunteers charge money, but when you consider transportation, when you consider hotel stays, when you consider all this stuff, it's horribly inefficient. Now, most of the cost is absorbed by the volunteers, but it is just a massively inefficient way to build homes. But still, some homes were built that way. Yeah? So then the question becomes, how do the recipients perceive the homes, and how does it affect the donors? Because there's two things that could happen. If donors go on these projects and then give away a lot more money in the future, you could make an argument that, well, even though they're not terribly efficient, at least they're given more money. The other question is, how does the different types of aid impact the recipients of these aids? So when the North Americans built the homes, the people appreciated what was done. They said, you know, we appreciate the fact that you built us a home. Thank you very much. It's nice of you to do that, and we thank you genuinely. They didn't think it was very rational when people are unemployed here that you've got these guys flying 3,000 miles and spending 2 weeks and spending all this money to do what they could have done for, you know, 1/15 the cost. But, you know, still. So there was some appreciation. When the locals built the houses, based on the surveys, the locals that received them were more grateful for the homes. They felt more ownership of the homes. They were more motivated to participate in other community projects, and they were more likely to pay off their loans on time. So you have a better effect when the locals are taking care of their own problems, even though some of the money for it might be coming from the United States. From the donor's perspective, a lot of people come back from these trips and say it's a life-changing experience. Now, in reality, it's certainly educational, and that's what I found for myself. But is it truly life-changing? The answer is no. He reviewed 13 studies, and of 11 studies that they found that in the future, people that have gone on these service project trips, for example, there was no increase in donation levels over time. Because they were studying a lot of religious-based things, they were also looking at mission work. The number of people that go on missions has actually been relatively constant over time, even though the number of people going on these short-term missions, a two-week project, has increased dramatically. So there was no, as that as a measurement, there was no increase. There was no increase in prayer. College kids that went were no more likely to hang out with people of different ethnicity. Oh, you guys know what I mean. Before versus after. So while I would certainly say it's educational, it certainly was not life-changing. So for sustainably oriented aid, the things that need to be done, and this is especially true when you're giving your own money, because a lot of people may come to you with different projects and stuff like that. You need to listen to what the donors need, not necessarily what we think we need. If you read books on like poor farmers that are subsistence levels farmers, you'll see that what they try to mainly spend money on is getting their kids educated and medical care. Getting their kids educated is critically important to them because that's Social Security to some degree. Actually, the number of kids being born in a lot of areas is going down, but they need the kids to be able to support them, and they've realized that if they can get a high school education, for example, in Kenya, your ticket may be written a lot better. And the problem when we decide what we want to donate, maybe we want to give them an oven that's more efficient and burns less wood. Well, that may be nice, but we may spend $500 to get this oven working for them, even though they may have allocated the money in a vastly different direction. So it's really important to hear what they want. The second thing is you don't compete against the community you're trying to help. And that's where I'm coming back to. There's nothing wrong with us, you know, and it's a noble thing to go help people to get out of poverty. But you don't do it by sending unskilled laborers to do unskilled labor when they have too many unskilled laborers to begin with. You do unique things. It might be teaching English, and it might be medical care or something like that. You don't undermine local businesses by bringing in stuff. And at Tenement is the Rotary project I talked about. It's a knee-jerk thing. We adopted our daughter, 13 years ago now. We went to Korea, to Seoul, to go visit the orphanage. And so what do? Well, what we say, well, orphanage, what do you need? We need diapers, we need da-da-da. So, of course, we have a suitcase full of diapers and onesies. Well, in Seoul, you can buy more diapers and onesies than you could ever buy in the United States. But it's just the perception that we have that, you know, we've got to bring something, even though it can be done there. Now, in Seoul, it really doesn't make much difference. They're an affluent community. But if you talk to an orphanage, they'll say, you know, we need clothing, we need da-da-da-da-da. And even if you, so what do? They say, well, send it over to us. So we air freight this stuff. Well, the orphanage would be smarter to network with a couple local places that sell clothing and say, look, can we coordinate with you so if people want to order stuff, they do it here, and then we're supporting local businesses. And then when that orphanage needs cash or gets in a crunch, maybe they can go to these schools or these clothing stores that they've been supporting, and they might be able to get something going in terms of a little more activity. Generally, the smaller projects works a lot better than bigger projects, and longer-term relationships work a lot better than short-term. If you're going in and out one time with a donation or anything else, you can't always tell if something worked. A lot of times, things don't work. They work miserably. But we never know, because we thought we did a great thing. We sent somebody clothing, but since we never go to that town, you don't realize that, by the way, that cute little town that you saw 5 years ago where you sent all this clothing, you wiped them out. But you were only there once, so, you know, that goes. So the projects that tend to work best are medical. It's very measurable to see if somebody's medical things got better. Water purification projects, it requires a little more technology than most communities can handle themselves. Vaccinations, education, and the last thing I want to talk about just briefly is microcredits. Microcredits are one of the most exciting things that's been happening, and I think we had a quote at the beginning of the thing that the problem with a lot of aid is it's reactive. It's reacting to problems. If you can imagine, for example, 20 years ago, China was a bad good case economically. If all we would have done is keep sending aid, I'll buy you a refrigerator, I'll buy you clothing, you couldn't do it. I mean, and it's with any community, people's needs are so great, you can never satisfy their needs. But if you can give somebody a job, because, you know, that's really just dealing with the effects of poverty. If you want to deal with the cause of poverty, they need to have a job. And a typical microcredit works, they usually get a group of 7 or 8 women. Women are much more reliable than men because they tend to drink the proceeds of the loan, where the women don't. And the loans tend to be short-term in nature, 3 to 6 months. The one our Rotary Club has started working with recently, the interest rates are like 2.5% a month, which is pretty high, but it's also that they're maybe borrowing $300. The loans are usually 3 to 6 months. It helps them get startup stuff, maybe to have supplies or whatever to get their business going. But if you can get somebody generating a business and starting to make their own money, they can allocate the money how they want. And it's just a vastly more efficient way, and treating the cause goes vastly further than treating the effect. So that is basically my spiel. Thank you. In terms of the Ayn Rand, and I actually like Ayn Rand, but what I'm saying is actually not, for example, to give the mosquito net. What I'm saying is you can vastly improve the economy of that local area by doing more research and being more involved and finding this mosquito net manufacturer and have it produced locally. You can do far more good with a lot of these things. Instead of, for example, like tenement, where I'm talking about painting, you'd be far better off donating an extra $100 on our projects and then have employing somebody for a week to do some of the painting while you're teaching English. You would be far better off for that community to still buy them the school supplies, but you set up some type of business where the money can be going through their system instead of us undermining. Now, it's great for our economy because we're buying all this stuff here, but it's undermining their economy. I'm not suggesting we don't do it. I'm just suggesting it. You do it in a different way that supports instead of undermines their economy. You know, there's a lot of different microcredit places. Some of them are good and some of them are bad. There are some rating agencies that can help you say how effective they are. So one we just started working with, for example, does some education also, because, you know, one concern with microcredits, and there's no panaceas, is that some of these people are borrowing too much money and they can never hope to pay it back. So, you know, you've got to be careful. There's a million organizations, and sifting through it is not easy. And I focus on overseas because that's where I know. But it's leading towards self-sufficiency, but that's why we need to fundamentally, in my view, change how the aid is given. Not that the aid is given at all, but you don't run over there and do it. You send some money over to do it, and if you want to go teach English, don't do a construction project. And that's a legitimate concern because corruption is endemic. That's one of the reasons you like to do very small projects instead of big projects. And sometimes it takes a little bit more work. And again, I'm not suggesting that you don't go down or even that construction may be appropriate if you're, like, let's say, an electrician. But for, you know, when I went, it was people like me, you know, I'm incompetent. I mean, I, you know, but, you know, there's far better skilled people. I mean, you know, just even with an aptitude. I mean, so, you know, there is, but there's other stuff you could do. You could be teaching English while you're at the same project where they're doing construction, and you could make sure that the money is being spent. Other things that the United States or China is doing this in Africa right now, you know, they do all this stuff for infrastructure building, and but they send all their Chinese companies or U.S. companies to go in and do it. And so now they build their whatever, and then they leave. Well, had you used locals to do it extensively, you're building up an infrastructure and a knowledge base to do it. And we just do projects, and then our guys get the money, and then there's dependency again. There are good projects. It's just a question of how you orient them. You know, and doctors, you know, they do good work, period. But if they're also training, because you don't always necessarily need a PhD, especially in rural areas. Sometimes you just need somebody that can do minor stuff more effectively. And then the only thing you have to worry about sometimes is when they say they want something, sometimes you got to think about what they want. When the orphanage says, I want diapers, yeah, that doesn't mean you bring in diapers from the United States. It means you find a source, and it may not be their town, maybe it's the next town over, it's a little bigger, as a source for those diapers.
Okay, thanks
okay.
so much.
Thank you.
Our closing words are these. Charity creates a multitude of sins. That was from Oscar Wilde. Charity creates a multitude of sins. But thanks for coming, and please extend the hand of friendship to your neighbors around you, and then join us for coffee and conversation. Thank you.